Welcome to Tax Chat with Mike DeBliss. I'm so happy that you've joined me in what is the first episode ever of Tax Chat, our maiden voyage. This is a podcast that's going to cover international tax compliance and topics relating to foreign asset reporting. If I haven't scared you away yet, here are some of the topics we're going to talk about. First, we'll discuss the requirements for the FBAR, the Foreign Bank Account Report, and Form 8938. Second, we're going to delve into the IRS's amnesty programs, including the streamlined procedures and the Offshore Voluntary Disclosure Program, or OVDP for short. Because a non-willfulness certification has become the cornerstone of the streamlined process, we're going to discuss when it might be appropriate to make a certification and when it isn't. We'll also discuss the controversial FATCA and the various agreements that the U.S. has in place with participating foreign banks and countries. We'll talk about the infamous Passive Foreign Investment Company, or PFIC. Finally, I hope to have some guests on, other tax professionals that I'll interview. Without further ado, let me introduce myself. I'm Mike DeBliss. I'm a tax attorney from New Jersey. I've been practicing law for the last 8 years, and my specialty is international tax compliance. Specifically, I do consulting and risk assessment for taxpayers who want to come into compliance with their U.S. tax obligations. I've been doing this work now for the last 2 years. In that time, I've gained a lot of insight. I'd like to share with you some interests that I have outside of tax to show you that I'm still human. I grew up playing ice hockey and went on to play hockey in college. Since hanging up my skates a while back, I've started running marathons. Typically, I'll run 10Ks and 5Ks. But what I'm most passionate about is improv. I got into improv about 2 years ago as a way of loosening up and being myself in front of a jury, and absolutely fell in love with it. Ever since then, I've been performing on an improv team. What's great about improv is that it's a great outlet in that it helps me to get out of my left brain. You know, the technical side, which we tax professionals spend most of our days stuck in. And that helps to stimulate creative thinking and fresh ideas. I find it absolutely liberating. When I tell people about my improv experience, I'm usually asked to describe the most embarrassing thing to have happened to me on stage. Imagine that. People want to know what the most embarrassing thing to have happened to me was. Now, I suppose that since I brought it up, that it's only fair for me to share this with you too. I promise you, I won't disappoint. A couple weeks ago, my improv team was playing to a full house. It was a Saturday night, and we had a pretty good crowd. There were about 200 people in the audience. I was on the back line while two of my teammates were on stage in the middle of a scene. Their scene inspired me to come on as a walk-on. Now, if you don't know what a walk-on is simply when a person comes on to add something to the scene or to enhance it, but not to shift focus away from the scene. In other words, a walk-on doesn't come on and selfishly say, "Look at me, look at me." As I took a bold step out, the next thing I knew, I was lying flat on the ground. I had gone flying. As I looked up, the bright lights were shining in my eyes. To add insult to injury, I noticed out of the side of my eye that the sole of my right shoe had peeled off and was dangling from the heel. I can't tell you how mortified I was. Now, if this were a scripted play, I suppose that the next thing to happen would be for the curtain to go down and the lights in the theater to go up for a short intermission so that the actors could all regain their composure. However, this was improv. And the cardinal rule of improv is that there are no mistakes, only gifts. My two scene partners immediately ran up to me, took me by the arm, and helped me up to my feet. The person on the right side of me said, "P Peter, how many times have I told you not to go dumpster diving at night? You know how bad your eyesight is. If this banana peel were any larger, it would have bitten you in the face." The audience erupted into laughter. After the show, members of the audience came up to us and said it was the best scene of the show. They even thought that it had been scripted, which is the biggest compliment that an improviser can get. To be candid, the stage can be a traumatic place. I mean traumatic, not dramatic. There have been many other times that I've left licking my wounds. At the same time, I wouldn't be where I am today without it. Finally, I have a huge entrepreneurial spirit. My goal in these podcasts is not to lecture to you. I realize that there are literally a dozen, if not more, things you could be doing right about now instead of listening to me talk. And I don't want to waste your time. Instead, my goal is to share with you some helpful tips that I've learned over the last 2 years in order to help you navigate the choppy seas of foreign asset reporting. I want to provide you with the most valuable content that I possibly can. As many of you are aware, international tax compliance is very technical and, yes, very dry. Yet, it's an area that I find fascinating. I just seem to have a great deal of intellectual curiosity about this field. I'm going to do my very best to make sense of everything and to make it interesting for you, or at least bearable. I hope to simplify the rules by starting with the basic building blocks. Once we build a solid foundation, it'll be easier to tackle the questions that keep us up at night. At times, I'll use hypotheticals. But remember that this is a podcast and not a webcast. In other words, I don't have visual aids. There will, however, be what I call notes available at the end of the podcast. For all intents and purposes, bullet points from the show that will be available for you to download. The point here is that the hypotheticals are intentionally designed to be simple and straightforward, since there aren't visual aids as there would be in a webinar. I'd like to start out by discussing some basic principles regarding the U.S.'s system of worldwide taxation. No other topic generates more confusion or more criticism than the U.S. system of worldwide taxation. At the same time, it's the very reason for international tax compliance. That's why it's so important to master these rules and to have a solid understanding of how it works. Let's discuss the problem of international double taxation. And we're going to focus on this for most of the rest of the session. The U.S. is one of the only countries left in the world that still taxes its citizens and residents on their worldwide income, regardless of where it's earned. That's hard to imagine. I remember when I first heard my law professor say that, it was really earth-shattering. It's hard to imagine that we are one of the only countries left that still tax our citizens and residents on their worldwide income. Under this system, jurisdiction to tax is based upon the political allegiance of the taxpayer. Now, I don't want to devolve into any legal definitions or legal speak right now, but I do this just to give you some background information. Political allegiance does have a definition. The U.S. defines that for tax purposes as a person's citizenship, regardless of his residence. So our system of worldwide taxation is sometimes referred to as citizenship-based taxation. Taxing U.S. citizens and residents on their worldwide income is not the only basis upon which a country can exercise jurisdiction to tax. So while it's our basis, it's not the only basis. And I'm sure you probably figured that out by what I said earlier about the U.S. being the only country left on Earth to still impose worldwide taxation of its citizens and residents. The other basis is source. Under source-based taxation, a nation taxes income or assets located within its borders, regardless of where the owner of such income or assets lives. Have you ever stopped to think about what the justification for the U.S.'s system of worldwide taxation is? Well, the traditional justification for U.S. worldwide taxation is public benefits, specifically the public benefits that stem from U.S. citizenship. Now, we could sit here debating this for probably a week, if not longer, but we're going to hold off on that and perhaps get into the rationale and the justification for the rationale in a future session. This all comes from the U.S. Supreme Court case of Cook versus Tate. In that case, the Supreme Court emphasized that government, by its very nature, benefits the citizen and his property wherever found. Remember what I just said, this is something that is highly controversial. So although Cook provides constitutional justification for citizenship-based taxation, I'd argue, and this is my opinion, that the benefits rationale is unpersuasive. Let's discuss now how international double taxation rears its ugly head. The scenario that gives rise to international double taxation is when a person is a citizen or a resident of the U.S., but derives income or holds assets in another country. So just keep that framework in your mind. And that's something that you want to issue spot whenever you have a client that comes to you with a potential tax problem. Again, when the person is a citizen or resident of the U.S. but derives income or holds assets in another country, that's what triggers international double taxation. Both the U.S. and the foreign country tax the same item of income as their own, and both countries have jurisdiction to tax the same item. The main cause of international double taxation is simple, just keeping that framework in mind. Inconsistent sourcing rules in different countries imposing overlapping taxes. Again, the whole cause for this quagmire for international double taxation is inconsistent sourcing rules in different countries imposing overlapping taxes. Now, there are ways that the U.S. has for mitigating the harsh effects of international double taxation. And we're going to get into a few of those as we go on here. There's also international tax treaties that the U.S. has with other countries. We're going to hold off from talking about international tax treaties until a later session. But let's take an example of how this international double taxation rears its ugly head. Let's assume that John is a lawyer from the U.S. who has international clients, some of whom live in Kuwait. Note for purposes of this example that the U.S. does not have a tax treaty with Kuwait. And again, we're going to talk about tax treaties in a later session. One day, when John is working from his office in Kuwait, the phone rings. The voice on the other end of the line is a Kuwaiti client who asks him to do some research on a question and prepare a memorandum. John goes ahead with the work, which consists of some research, some thinking, and some writing. His final product is a memo, which he sends to his Kuwaiti client, along with a bill for $4,000. Remember, John's a lawyer. A check for $4,000 arrives by return mail. Now let's deconstruct this problem. Let's first discuss the U.S. tax liability for this income, and then the Kuwaiti tax liability. This is foreign source income from the perspective of the U.S. Treasury. Why? Well, under the U.S. tax system, income takes its source from the place of economic activity that gives rise to it. Because all the work that produced the memo was done in Kuwait, it's Kuwaiti source income. Remember that John did the work in Kuwait. Even though this is foreign source income from the perspective of the U.S. Treasury, John must still pay taxes on this $4,000 to the U.S. Treasury. And that's simply because John is a U.S. citizen and is subject to U.S. tax on his worldwide income. Worldwide income includes domestic source income and foreign source income. From the perspective of the U.S. Treasury, John has $4,000 of foreign source income. Now let's turn to John's Kuwaiti tax liability. John's not going to get off so easily. From the perspective of the Kuwaiti Treasury, John has domestic source income. Why? Well, the $4,000 was paid by a Kuwaiti citizen to John, so it came out of Kuwait's economy. And so Kuwait wants to tax what it believes is rightfully theirs. As a matter of U.S. law, John owes tax on $4,000. And as a matter of Kuwaiti law, John owes tax on $4,000. Right about now, you might be sensing a problem. Both the U.S. and Kuwait are taxing the same item of income as their own. There lies the problem. Let's assume that John's income tax rate is 50%, both in the U.S. and in Kuwait. All right, and I realize that 50% is likely unrealistic, but I'm trying to keep the figures the numbers as easy as possible for purposes of number crunching. Hold back your comments on how the income tax rate for John is unrealistic. Again, this is only for purposes of simplifying the problem and the math. U.S. taxable income on account of the fee would be $4,000. And at a 50% rate, John's U.S. income tax liability would be $2,000. John's Kuwaiti income tax liability would also be $2,000. The combined tax payments to Kuwait and the U.S. in the amounts of $2,000 each have wiped out John's income from the venture. This harsh result is international double taxation personified. It is the Grinch that stole Christmas. If it were the norm, double taxation of this sort would halt international activity, economic activity, dead in its tracks. So how does the U.S. deal with this? Or does it even deal with this? While the company line is worldwide taxation of citizens without regard to their residences, this policy is abated in a few respects. In the income tax setting, the most important abatement of the U.S.'s system of worldwide taxation is none other than the foreign tax credit. The foreign tax credit lies at the heart of the system of outbound U.S. taxation. Now, I want you to put off to the side what you already know about the foreign tax credit. I want you to pretend that you're hearing about this for the first time so that you can approach it with an open mind. I'm going to start off with some basic principles, which are the building blocks. The foreign tax credit rests on a simple idea. How simple? Well, it's this simple. Income taxes paid to the U.S. Treasury are reduced or credited by the amount of income taxes paid by the U.S. person to the foreign government. I'll repeat that again. Income taxes paid to the U.S. Treasury are reduced or credited by the amount of income taxes paid by U.S. persons to foreign governments. Before returning to the example, let me explain to you what I mean by a tax credit. A tax credit is nothing more than a dollar-for-dollar reduction of U.S. income tax by the amount of foreign income tax. The tax savings from a credit is the exact amount of the credit itself. The credit is available only to the extent that the taxpayer pays foreign income taxes on foreign source income at or below the rate at which the U.S. taxes such income. I'll repeat that again. The credit is available only to the extent that the taxpayer pays foreign income taxes on foreign source income at or below the rate at which the U.S. taxes such income. This will all make sense in a little while when we go through the next hypothetical. By using the foreign income tax credit, the U.S. surrenders the tax it would otherwise collect from a citizen or resident with foreign source income to the foreign country from which the income was derived. Let's consider an example where the U.S. income tax rate and the foreign country's income tax rates are identical. Suppose that Adam is a U.S. citizen and that he owns a condominium in country X that he rents out during the year. Let's also assume that he's in a 30% federal income tax bracket in the U.S. and a 30% income tax bracket in country X. Suppose that Adam earns $100 from renting his condo in country X. Adam properly reports his rental income as part of his worldwide income on his U.S. tax return. Thankfully, there are no badges of fraud that might suggest that Adam is engaging in, let us say, tax hanky-panky. We can all recognize that country X is a source jurisdiction. Adam's income tax liability in country X would be $30. The U.S. tax on that same income, pre-credit, would also be $30. However, instead of paying $30 to the U.S. Treasury, Adam can credit the $30 he paid to country X against the tax he would otherwise owe to the U.S. So, at the end of the day, Adam would not owe any tax to the U.S. Treasury on his foreign source rental income. Very simply, the income tax paid to country X completely offsets Adam's U.S. foreign source tax liability. Adam's effective tax rate would be 30%, because remember, the country X income tax bracket that he was in was 30%, and we're talking $100 of rental income. So we're talking $30 of tax that he has to pay to country X treasury. And that turns into an effective tax rate of 30%. And the significance of that is that it's the same as if that income had been earned by a U.S. citizen. The effective tax rate, that is the same as if that income had been earned by a U.S. citizen within the U.S. Let's consider an example where the foreign jurisdiction's income tax rate is less than the U.S.'s income tax rate. Suppose that country X imposes taxes on Adam at a 20% bracket. Keep in mind that Adam is in a 30% bracket in the U.S. Adam will pay $20 of tax to country X. 20% of $100 is $20. He'll take a credit on his federal tax return for that $20 income tax payment. After subtracting $20 from $30, Adam pays a net tax to the U.S. of $10 on his rental income from his condo in country X. What's the conventional view here? Well, credit for foreign income taxes prevents double taxation by giving the source jurisdiction, which in this example was country X, the priority to tax. I'd like to pause here for a second. I realize that many of you listening today are tax professionals. I have a question for you. Would you be interested in a session that covers public speaking tips for the tax professional? And the reason why I ask that question is public speaking for those in technical fields like tax is extremely challenging. Why? Taking complicated ideas and simplifying them so that they can be understood by lay audiences is no small feat. On top of that, we have to deal with other baggage when it comes to public speaking. We have to deal with something that is so frightening as speaking in public. In fact, our fear of standing up in front of a group and talking is so great that, according to surveys, we fear it even more than death itself. As for me, one of my greatest public speaking struggles is my inner critic. I am, hands down, my own worst critic. I admit that I sometimes stay up hours and hours after a presentation, obsessing about a particular part that didn't go the way I wanted it to go. The trick for a great performance, in my opinion, is to know what works for you, why it works, and how to repeat it again and again. That's the winning formula. And that comes down to hard work, training, and yes, experience. So my question to you is this: have you ever had to give a high-stakes presentation? If so, what, if any, struggles did you encounter? How did you overcome them? I'd love to hear from you. At the end of the podcast, I'll give you my email address, and I welcome all comments. I would like to talk a little bit now about the difference between a credit and a deduction. And I think this will help solidify the concept of the foreign tax credit. Unlike a credit, a deduction is a reduction of taxable income by the amount of a given expense. I'd like to stop just for a second. My fear here is that I will confuse some of you out there. And again, my purpose in doing this comparison right now is merely to help drive home the concept of a credit. But I have to admit, I am deathly afraid that this might blur the lines and actually be more confusing. So I'm going to try to present as simple a hypothetical as possible to walk you through this. The tax savings from a deduction is the amount of tax that would otherwise have been imposed on the deducted amount. So here's the example. Let's say that the U.S. and foreign income tax rates are both 30%. If they were both 30%, there would be a foreign tax of 30 cents on a dollar of foreign source income. U.S. taxable income would be $1. Again, we're talking about foreign source income is $1. Let's not get preoccupied with any U.S. source income. We're only talking foreign source income now. So U.S. taxable income would be $1, which represents the total amount of foreign source income. Deduction of the foreign tax would reduce U.S. foreign source income by 30 cents, leaving 70 cents subject to tax. All we're doing is taking that $1 and we're subtracting the foreign tax of 30 cents. That's how we come up with 70 cents that are that's subject to U.S. tax. Now remember, we have to come up with the actual tax. Recall that I said it was a 30% tax rate in the U.S. as well. So 30% of 70 cents is 21 cents. For every dollar of foreign source income, the taxpayer would pay 51 cents of tax, 30 cents to the foreign government and 21 cents to the U.S. The taxpayer would have 49 cents left over after payment of all taxes. So here is the punchline. When deducted rather than credited, the payment of 30 cents of foreign income tax reduces U.S. income tax by only 9 cents. The taxpayer would end up paying tax to two different countries at the overall effective rate of 51 cents. For this reason, it's preferable to credit an amount against taxes than to deduct it from income. Now, just so we don't leave John hanging out there, let's return to his example and show him that there is some light at the end of the tunnel. To blunt the harsh effect of international double taxation, as we've already discussed, the U.S. will allow John a dollar-for-dollar offset of the Kuwaiti tax against his U.S. income tax. Let's go back to this crazy income tax rate of 50%, just again, for purposes of simplifying the numbers. Let's assume that John's U.S. and Kuwaiti income tax brackets are 50%. John's U.S. taxable income from the venture would be $4,000. Remember, that's the amount that his Kuwaiti client paid him for drafting the memo. At a 50% tax rate, John's pre-credit U.S. tax would be $2,000. However, John's U.S. tax would be reduced to zero by a tax credit of $2,000 for income tax paid to Kuwait. With a U.S. tax credit, the combined effect of Kuwaiti and U.S. tax is the same as a 50% rate imposed by either country on its own. With a full foreign tax credit, there is no double taxation. Now, I want to point out something subtle. The U.S. only allows a tax credit for foreign taxes imposed on foreign source income. This is why the sourcing rules are so important. If the income is not considered foreign source, then the foreign tax credit doesn't apply. In other words, if the U.S. ever considered John's income to be U.S. source as opposed to Kuwaiti source, John would be, as we might sometimes refer to it, SOL. Under what circumstances might this income be classified as domestic source income as opposed to Kuwaiti source income? Well, here's one example. Let's suppose that John drafted the memo for the Kuwaiti client in New York City and not in Kuwait. In that case, no credit would be allowed. Why? Well, under the U.S. sourcing rules, John's income would be considered U.S. source and not Kuwaiti source. This gets back to the sourcing rule for earnings that we talked about earlier. Under U.S. tax law, income is sourced from the place of economic activity that gave rise to it. Because the work that went into drafting the memo would have taken place in the U.S., the place of economic activity that gave rise to it was the U.S. Therefore, John's fee is U.S. source income, and it would not, and he would not be entitled to a credit. Let's take a small digression to discuss territorial taxation. Many countries practice territorial taxation. Territorial taxation limits taxation to income from sources within a country's boundaries, regardless of who derives it, whether it's earned by a citizen or resident or anyone else. A good way of remembering a territorial tax system is like this. Territorial tax systems accommodate other tax systems in the simplest way possible by not extending their own beyond their borders. The problem of double taxation is tamed by taking no account of foreign income, whether earned by a citizen, resident, or anyone else. Consider this example. Vivek is a Kuwaiti citizen who works in an office in Kuwait. Assume that Kuwait follows a territorial system of tax where it only taxes Kuwaiti source income. A U.S. client asks Vivek to do some work, which he agrees to do for $4,000. Because this income is considered foreign source income from the perspective of the Kuwaiti Treasury, this income would not be taxed by the Kuwaiti Treasury. My point in weaving in this example of a territorial tax system is not to confuse you, but to make yet another point. The difference between territorial and worldwide tax systems are similar than first appear. What do I mean by that? Well, you'll need to think a little deep right now, but at the very core of this, the combination of worldwide taxation and a foreign tax credit approximates the effect of territorial taxation. This is very logical. In other words, when foreign tax rates And this is the condition for that to apply. When foreign tax rates are roughly the same as U.S. rates, it doesn't matter whether the U.S. Treasury simply ignores foreign income or allows an offset of its own tax by a comparable amount paid to the foreign government. The operable phrase there is when foreign tax rates are roughly the same as U.S. rates. When foreign tax rates are roughly the same as U.S. rates, it doesn't matter whether the U.S. Treasury simply ignores foreign income or allows an offset of its own tax by a comparable amount paid to the foreign government. Now, the U.S. employs other means to tame the beast. And what I mean by that is, when I'm referring to the beast, I mean the taxation of worldwide income of its citizens and residents. For example, there is the exclusion under Section 911 for the personal service income of non-resident citizens, and there is the exclusion under Section 911 for non-resident citizens' housing costs. We'll get into that in a later podcast session. We'll also get into the requirements of the Section 911 exclusion in a future session as well. This ends our first session. I'd like to leave you with a question to consider that we will revisit in our next session. Do you think that the U.S.'s system of worldwide taxation of its citizens and residents is justifiable under a benefits rationale? What do I mean by a benefits rationale? Well, are the benefits associated with U.S. citizenship strong enough to justify the U.S. casting such a wide net, meaning imposing its system of worldwide taxation on its citizens and residents? I want you to keep a few things in mind here. What are these benefits? There are three. I'll tell you what they are. They are civil rights, political rights, and social rights. And in this context, I want you to think about the non-resident U.S. citizen who lives outside of the U.S. and whether that person is in a position to take advantage of any of these benefits. And I'm not phrasing this question in a way to suggest that this person may or may not be able to or rather may not be able to take advantage of one or more of these rights. As I'm sure most of you realize, political rights and the right to vote is something that U.S. citizens enjoy, whether they are living in the United States or outside of the United States. The next thing I want you to pay special attention to are individuals who are born in a foreign country and who obtain their U.S. citizenship derivatively from a parent who happens to be a U.S. citizen. Do these individuals, who are sometimes referred to as accidental Americans, do these individuals enjoy the benefits associated with U.S. citizenship, namely civil rights, political rights, and social rights, enough to justify the U.S. taxing them on their worldwide income? So these are very interesting questions to ponder. And as you can imagine, there are arguments on both sides. But I would like to get into a spirited discussion about this in our next podcast. So I'd love to get your feedback from the first session. How did you like it? Should I quit while I'm ahead? I want to know the good, the bad, and the ugly. Only through constructive criticism will I be able to enhance the quality of future sessions. You can email me at mjthebliss@theblisslaw.com. My last name is spelled D as in David, E as in Edward, B as in boy, L-I-S. Thank you so much for listening. I enjoyed the time that we spent together, and I look forward to speaking to you in a future broad podcast. Have a great holiday and see you in 2015.